You are listening to a sermon by Ruth Enns, preceded by the singing of Dies Irae, as led by J. Evan Kreider. This recording was made on Sunday, July 8, 2012, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speakers are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
This was probably spoken at the funerals of my ancestors who were Catholic. It was probably never sung because they were poor, they couldn't afford to pay to have any singing done. But if you were given a proper Catholic burial and went through various rites leading up to that, these words, particularly after 1400, would have been heard. The monks and cathedrals would have sung them, and then it caught on from that. So we're going to sing. A few things to say about it. Don't worry about the shape of the notes. It's square because the pen was thick, and to make one note, you just go across. So you don't have to make a box in color, color, color. There's not enough time for that. It's just one stroke. All notes are created equal, except those with a dot, and we'll hold those longer. If notes touch each other, we'll treat them separately. So in the first line for the word solvet, you'll see that there are two notes on top of each other. If they're directly piled up, you sing the lower one first. Otherwise, for saeculum, where two notes touch, you sing them in order from left to right. The tiny little notes at the end of each line are the custos, the custodians. They just tell you what the next pitch is on the next line. Don't worry about them. I guess we'll do this at pitch. Just enough. I'll sing the first measure. That's the most famous, and that's the one people knew the most. Dies Irae, Dies La. I'll do it again. Dies Irae, Dies La. Join me.
Dies Irae, Dies La.
I'm not sure there's anything in the melody that says Day of Wrath. That day of that you dread, but there is sort of a dark quality to it. The next phrase, solvet saeculum in favilla. Join me. Singing Quantus.
Quantus traitores futurus, quaurudes est venturus, cum nos sicte Christus.
Then to say,
qui cum misertum iturus,
what patron can I beseech?
Quem patronum rogaturus,
when even the just person is scarcely safe.
Cum misertum.
this majesty.
Rex tremendi.
The redeemed for free.
Quis salvato salvas gratis.
Save me, O font of pity.
Salva me, dons pietatis.
It is an axiom of music history textbooks I deal with that the foundation of the Western musical heritage is Gregorian chant, the collection of texts and melodies developed in the Christian church during the dusky past of the medieval era. The chant best known to the students of my classes is the subject of my talk today, the Dies Irae, Day of Wrath, describing in hair-raising terms the day each of us will stand before God to be judged. The poem was written late in the Gregorian chant zone, around 1250. It is ascribed to Thomas of Celano, a monk who wrote the first biographies of St. Francis of Assisi, whom he knew. The Dies Irae is in the poetic form of a sequence, meaning it has Latin poetry with pairs of three-line verses. This morning, if you look at the handout, you can see I've written some things along the left-hand side. This morning we sang two of the three pairs that use the first section of the melody of the chant, the famous part of the melody. Around the time this was written, it was popular to add sequences to the regular service lineup, and it didn't take long before Dies Irae started turning up in requiem services, the Mass for the dead. The poem has evidence that the general avoidance of things Roman was easing up in Western Christianity by this time. In line 3, the poet includes the Sibyl as a prophet, along with David. According to Greek and Roman mythology, Sibyls were women in whom the gods confided the secrets of the future. Surely the Dies Irae was known to Dante when 50 years later he wrote his famous Inferno, a guide to hell, in which he delighted in devising excruciatingly appropriate punishments for people he didn't like. Like the Dies Irae, the Inferno is written in stanzas of 3 lines and includes references to ancient Roman culture. Most obviously, in Dante's Guide Through Hell, the Roman poet Virgil, who had written his own description of the afterlife in his great epic, Aeneas. As you can see from the left-hand column of the handout, the repetitions in the chant melody that goes A-A-B-B-C-C, A-A-B-B-C-C, A-A-B-B-C, and then D-E-F, create 3 large groupings in the text, verses 1 to 6, 7 to 12, and 13 to 17. Then at the end, in stanza 18, there is a pair of couplets, breaking the pattern of 3-line stanzas, and a final unrhymed prayer. In the first grouping, verses 1 to 6, a fearsome judgment day is imagined. Trumpet calls summon all souls, dead and alive, to appear before the judge. The giant book in which all human deeds are recorded is brought forth, and the judge takes his seat. All will be revealed. There will be no secrets. That is the big picture. In the next section, things get personal. What will I say when I am in that position? What hope can I possibly have? This king of judgment is known to get angry, lose patience. This is the point at which composers tend to unleash the trombones. This king is so far beyond us, such an imposing figure. My only hope can be in his mercy, not in any value I might have. or action I might take. Rather than think more about that, I decide to think of gentle Jesus. His willingness to die for mankind is some encouragement. I realize all I can do is plead for forgiveness. The third section begins with a reference to known sinners who received pardon from Jesus: Mary Magdalene and the thief on the cross beside him. Here is a ray of hope. Some months ago, John Clausen talked to us about the sheep of Christ. The theology here reminds me of his remarks on the passage of the sheep and the goats from Matthew 25. What makes you acceptable to God? It is not your actions. It is only that you love God. God is beyond us, but confessing your sin can lead to forgiveness. This is what the poem tells us. The last of the three-line stanzas is a plea for help. Bowed down in supplication, I beg thee, my heart as though ground to ashes, help me in my last hour. There has been some speculation that the final lines of the poem were added later and could have been written by someone else. There's a switch from first person singular, pardon me, help me, to the third person. Have mercy on mankind as he rises from the ashes to come before you. And there is a switch from three-line stanzas to couplets. Like in a Shakespearean sonnet, the couplets sum up the argument and bring a feeling of closure, winding things down from a considerable level of intensity. The final prayer, Pia Jesu Domine, Dona Eis Requiem, Gentle Lord Jesus, grant them rest, disrupts the regularity of both rhythm and rhyme. Instead of the relentless strong weak, strong weak, strong weak stresses of the rest of the poem, the lines are shorter and end with a lyrical triplet rhythm, and rhyme is lost completely. The grammatical tense moves to thoughts of them, and the words echo the first movement of the Requiem Mass. Eternal rest give them, O God. The poet is able to move beyond thoughts of his own destiny and pray for the souls of all humanity. The Dies Irae was one of only four sequences to be retained in services after the great liturgical purge of the Counter-Reformation in the 16th century. A sure sign the cardinals recognized the power of this text. It remained a standard item in the Requiem until Vatican II, the reforms of around 1962. By then, its Latin and its harsh reminder of Judgment Day were considered old-fashioned, and it was replaced in the modern Requiem service by messages of comfort and hope. But for 700 years, this was a familiar text and melody to Christians around the world. Although the Dies Irae has been mostly supplanted in services, it very much lives on in concert music. I want to talk briefly about how this text has been presented in musical settings through the years, and also how the melody associated with the text has become a musical symbol in its own right. When you listen to monks singing the poem to the original chant melody, there's a strong disconnect between the calm, meditative singing and the blazing imagery of the text. The music helps to tame the words or ritualize them to make the concept of judgment more bearable and more communal. During the Renaissance, the first polyphonic settings of this text appeared, but often the Dies Irae was sung to chant, even in polyphonic services. One general principle observable in service music was that important texts should be sung to plain music to make sure the words could be understood. Perhaps it was respect for the poem that kept the music relatively subdued. Evan says God could hear better when the text was sung to chant. By the 18th century, composers were exploiting the text's dramatic potential. Anyone who's seen the movie Amadeus has an image of the dying Mozart in his bed, struggling to dictate the intensely emotional music he had in his head for this text. He died before he could complete his requiem, but the ideas for the Dies Irae were recorded as a fairly complete sketch, and this music quickly became a symbol of the tragedy of the young composer himself. It was probably an inspiration for a long line of romantic treatments of the text. Verdi, in 1874, for example, gave it the full operatic treatment, chanting choir, soaring soprano, sobbing mezzo, trumpets all ablaze from the balcony. This is a setting from a composer in the Catholic tradition at the height of his powers as an opera composer. Little wonder that some composers, like Faure, whose requiem the Abendmusik choir sang this spring at Lent, chose not to set the Dies Irae with its disturbing imagery. The only part of the text that he put to music was the Pia Jesu, the final prayer for the souls of the dead. Gentle Jesus, grant them rest. Some of you might remember this as Andrea's lovely soprano solo. In Britain's War Requiem of 1962, the choir chants the Dies Irae as tenor and baritone soloists sing the words of several poems by World War I poet Wilfred Owens, which describe the horror of war. Britain intended his composition as a statement of his pacifist stance, and much of the poignancy of his setting comes from the combination of the collective statement of the choir singing in Latin and the modern individual's personal experience related in English. Out there, we've walked quite friendly up to death, sat down and eaten with him, cool and bland, begins one of those poems. Berlioz in 1830 was the first to use the melody of the old chant to evoke fear of death in a purely instrumental, secular piece. In the last movement of the Symphonie Fantastique, he called on the familiar melody to shock his French Catholic audiences with association of death and dread, and also outrage, depicting abominable creatures of the night who gather to celebrate death and mock the solemnity of the sacred chant, and with it, the sanctity of the church. This brainwave of musical symbolism was quickly adopted by other 19th century composers of devilish leanings. Liszt, Saint-Saëns, Tchaikovsky, Mahler, Rachmaninoff, Stravinsky, and Shostakovich are some of the many who refer to the opening line of the chant melody. Sometimes just the first four notes, jilam, bom, 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 to incorporate allusions to fear, death, and the supernatural. Rachmaninoff, in particular, developed a relationship with this melody. It pops up in eight of his works that I know about, sometimes as a theme, but more often as something that inevitably comes up along the way somewhere. He was not Catholic, he was raised Russian Orthodox, but the melody seems to have become associated with his own obsessions and unhappiness. In more recent times, although many would argue that the Catholic Church has lost its relevance for many people in the Western world, this piece of chant lives on. In George Crumb's electric string quartet, Black Angels, of 1970, the Dies Irae melody is used in the context of music representing an anti-war protest with full reference to its old associations of fear and death, now with the slant of the Cold War fear of world annihilation and spiritual death. In the most recent edition of the music history text I used to teach, there's a new piece based on the old Dies Irae melody by American composer Michael Dougherty. Here we get a postmodern interpretation. The piece is called Dead Elvis for solo bassoon accompanied by chamber ensemble. The bassoonist is instructed to dress up as Elvis Presley, and the music is a set of variations using American pop styles, 50s rock, Latin jazz, Las Vegas showbiz, all ringing changes on the tune Dies Irae. Gone are all its associations of the sacred, the solemn, the fearful, or even the diabolical. It is an abstract object of quaint historical lineage, reused in the spirit of gentle spoof and general gaiety. A website called requiemsurvey.org has an extensive list of musical settings of the Requiem, and it is striking that many more were written in the 20th century than in any previous era. 1,563 are identified. And in the 21st century, there are already 386 listings. One of them is called Requiem for a Dying Planet. Another combines the old Latin words with references to other religions of the world. Clearly, this is a text for our time. During his last talk here, John Clausen made the remark that religion is woven into the fabric of our culture, and many people now have no awareness of it. I hope my brief presentation has increased your awareness of the Dies Irae, a diamond among the gems of Christian hymnody.